It's so great to have you tuned in today. Good morning to you. It's 6 minutes after 10 o'clock on this Thursday, the 20th day of September. Pat Daly with you here, looking forward to a conversation this morning with my pal Chris White, who is here to do our monthly church history hit. Our pal Matt is not with us today. Matt's on vacation, and so we'll let him enjoy his time off. But we do want to continue on here with a look this morning at John Wesley. Now, Wesley is probably a name you've heard of. If I think of John Wesley, the first associations that come to my mind are Methodism and hymns. Actually, maybe, I don't know if that was John or Charles, but
that was his brother Chuck.
That was Chuck,
yeah,
who wrote most of the music, but some really good hymns there. I've enjoyed those. But and also an important player in the early part of this country. Outside of that, I don't know a whole lot. So, Chris, that's why you're here today, to kind of help us get a handle on this guy and how he was relevant to the church, particularly in this country.
You know, Pat, it is good to be here. And kind of an exciting figure, very fruitful person, John Wesley was. He lived an incredibly long life. He was born in 1703 and died in 1791. So you can just imagine, with a lifespan of almost 88 years, the type of things that he got to see in his particular lifetime. He was the 15th child out of 19 different kids. Yeah, and his younger brother Charles, he and his younger brother Charles, of course, are the most well known. But you know, the story that probably anybody who's ever heard anything about John Wesley all knows is the story about how his life and the founding of Methodism really is credited to his mother.
Really?
Yeah. He his mother and father, he was a preacher's kid, and his father Charles was an Anglican minister, and they lived in a parsonage in England, and out of town. He was kind of a mucky muck in the church, and was, you know, at different district meetings and things like that all the time. So frequently he was vacant from his pulpit. And his mother, Susanna Wesley, was more of a Puritan and had a lot of roots in the Puritans. And she began having, on these Sundays when her husband was away, home meetings in their parsonage, in which she would invite you know, neighbors and invite their servants. In those days, almost everybody had domestic help, and she would invite their servants and their families to come together, and she would do a church service in her home, and would read the best of well-published sermons to all those who were invited.
Really?
You know, they were, in those days they didn't have tape ministries, and so if you were a good preacher, frequently your sermons would be put into print and bound in book form, and she had access to a nice library and would read. And many believe that that was very foundational, because the real foundation stone of Methodism, of course, was the small group meeting. And young John would have been at present at those meetings, and those would have had a very profound influence on his life.
This was back in jolly old
England, that's
okay.
Right. And then Wesley grows up. One of the things, of course, another well-known story is the fact that when he was a child, their parsonage burned down, and he was actually caught in the house and rescued out of this big house fire. And his mother, Susanna Wesley, of course, continually drummed it into his head, you know, you are a brand plucked from the fire, and you have a special mission with God, you know.
Wow.
That God has seen fit to spare your life, and really builds that. And then Wesley grows up and goes off. He was able to go to Oxford University. He was actually a student there, you know, this is where the elite were educated, of course. And him and C.S. Lewis and countless others, of course, went to Oxford University. And during that time, there was a kind of a movement, I guess, if you will, on campus, where the Christians, and actually many of the members of the student body, were going through the classic Christian literature of the church. And this kind of goes back to the very first show we ever did, because one of the things that really caught John Wesley's attention was reading the letters of the church fathers and the desert fathers. And he was utterly enthralled with how they were taking their faith and living it out practically in their relationships with other people, to their neighbors, to their community. And at the particular time in England, religion was sort of an affair of the mind and sort of the heart, but it had no real social consequences. And of course, Wesley then, in a desire to live that out, forms this group of people on the Oxford campus called the Holy Club.
Okay.
And the Holy Club is a group of people that want to take their spiritual life deeper. They want to deepen their devotion to God, but they also want to live it out with social concern. And that's a big, big picture, a big part of the picture in Wesley's life. And later, this, of course, develops into what we know as Methodism.
Oh, I was going to say, you've mentioned a little bit earlier that one of the hallmarks of Methodism is social conscience. And so this goes all the way back, I mean, even to this day, that goes back to Wesley then and the Holy Club at Oxford?
Absolutely. Wesley was a man who really loved the poor. He himself, interestingly, was a very wealthy man. He actually came into his wealth relatively inadvertently. He kind of stumbled into his wealth, and how that came about was the fact that he preached all the time, and he was an eloquent and excellent preacher, very well educated. He preached at a level that really resonated with the people of his time, and people loved to hear him. And his sermons were published in book form and were widely read and very popular, and he got book royalties. And, you know, it was like, so I'm rich, so sue me, you know. And yet he lived a life of near poverty. He had a very strong sense that wealth is something that God gives to you to distribute amongst the poor, that it's something that God entrusts you as a resource. And in his lifetime, it's believed that he gave away somewhere upwards of about £30,000, which in our currency today is about $40,000. But you got to remember what $40,000 was back in the 1700s. That was quite a significant chunk of change. But Wesley loved the poor. He had a genuine love for the poor. He appreciated the fact that they seemed to live a normal life, that they were unencumbered by all the fal-de-ras of being in high society. And he really had an affinity for them and really made a career of reaching out. He is the developer of all sorts of different social programs, orphanages, mm-hmm. medical clinics, schools. The Sunday school is really kind of an innovation of Methodism. In those days, of course, you know, we think of Sunday school as kind of an adjunct to our Sunday services at church, where in those days what Sunday school was an outreach to child labor. In England in particular at that time, children were the main workers in the coal mines in England, and most of them would work 10 to 12 hours a day underground and were living without an education and really doomed to a life of abject poverty because they were isolated from any of the benefits of society. And so the Sunday school movement was actually something Wesley did as an outreach to have these kids come and be taught how to read and how to write. And in the process of that, he shared the scripture with them. And so social concern is a real big part of John Wesley. And you see that alive today in some of the branches of Methodism that exist today.
Okay, so we had the social programs, the emphasis there, and of course he, a wealthy man, gave most of what he had away, lived a life of poverty. But where does Methodism come in? Does that, as opposed to the Holy Club, when did it get to call Methodism?
Methodism comes about down the road. You know, the Holy Club kind of mushrooms, and of course Wesley is an evangelist and a preacher, and he goes around the countryside, and one of the things that a lot of people don't realize is that he was extremely unpopular and rejected, even though the common man flocked to him.
Yeah.
The established church totally rejected him, and he worked amidst incredible opposition, stoning, mobs coming in that were sent to break up his meetings. He was incredibly disliked, and this is what gives birth to Methodism, is this incredible opposition from the organized church.
Why?
He upset the status quo is you know, the best guess, and you know, preaching some of his doctrines were disliked. The preaching of what he called Christian perfection, which was a doctrine that essentially believed that Christians would never become perfect in this life, mm-hmm. but through their relationship with the Holy Spirit, through their devotion to God, through acts of piety and through charity, could be moving closer to becoming a perfect man. And this is something that is, of course, embraced more in the Wesleyan and Nazarene strains of the Methodist Church today, as opposed to such as the United Methodist strain, which more emphasizes the social concerns. So Wesley is building this organization of small group ministry, outreach and all that, from the established Church of England. And in doing so, there came a point where he needed to have ordained ministers, because he obviously couldn't do all this work on his own. And so in that process, he begins his own separate organization that I don't believe he ever called it Methodism, but it was called Methodist by outsiders as a derogatory term. And they called him, well, you're nothing but Methodist, because of his emphasis on Bible reading and on prayer and church attendance and giving and all that. And they said, you know, your whole devotion to the Lord is related to your methods. But then also some say that it comes to the fact that Wesley was a genius at organization. And so the Methodism is his methods of organization. So both these things are very true, but that's where the whole Methodist thing comes away, is he builds this ministry outside of the organized church, and then eventually it needs to come of age, if you will. And so it breaks away and becomes its own religion, so to speak, within, of course, the Christian religion.
So this is still taking place then in England with John Wesley and what's going on there. I know that he came to the United States, is that right?
Now, one of the things a lot of people confuse Wesley with is with George Whitefield. George Whitefield and John Wesley are contemporaries. They're good friends. But John Wesley, he comes to the United States back before we were the United States. We were still the colonies of England. And he comes as a missionary to the colony of Georgia. And he's thinking that he's sent out by the Anglican Church, and he's around 31, 32, and he's thinking he's going to come here, and he's going to be a missionary to the Indians. And he comes here for 1 year and has an abysmal year. Methodism doesn't catch on. He doesn't catch on. His ministry has real limited success. He never makes it to the Indians. That just never happened. And he does have some moderate success with Anglicans living in the colony of Georgia. But after about a year, he heads back to England. And so he has really not much time here in the United States. Another thing that's interesting...
Is that the whole experience?
That's his
whole
sum total of his
US?
Time here. Now, okay. I know he comes back to appoint some leadership in the Methodist Church after the United States is formed. But interestingly... John Wesley opposed the American Revolution. George Whitefield was in favor of the American Revolution. Wesley opposes it and says that the colonists have no right to rebel against England, and actually publishes tracts and things to that effect, which makes him very unpopular with the people, his followers here in the United States at the time. So he actually came out and was against the Revolutionary War. So
how about that? So when he came to Georgia as a missionary, was he pretty well known, and hadn't been that much ostracized then by the Anglican Church? Or?
He was still a part of the and had not really come into full flower with his ministry yet. His full flower of his ministry actually happens after he returns back to England following this 1 year hiatus in the colony. So it's an interesting story. It also is the beginning, really, of his incredibly miserable love life that he has.
Well, I was going to ask. That was the miserable love life. Golly, I thought William Carey had it the worst.
No, William Carey didn't have it the worst. Actually, William Carey found love in his life where, actually, John Wesley, though he was an incredibly popular preacher, though he was an incredibly gifted writer and speaker and organizer and was a phenomenal genius of a man and a genius in the church, in leading the church, and he did these wonderful things. His own personal love life was an incredible disaster. While he's in Georgia, he meets really this young convert who's the love of his life, and basically he says, "Well, I'm not going to take this any further. I'm just afraid if I get married right now that it's going to mess my work up." And so he backs off on this love relationship. And then he thinks the better of it and tries to make up with her, but by that time she shuns him and goes and marries someone else. So he loses his first love.
And this was in America?
This is in America, okay, yeah. Then he goes back to England, and a few years later, him and his brother Charles make this covenant with one another that neither of them would marry without the approval of the other brother, that they had to approve.
Okay.
And you know, 7-8 years later, Methodism is going really strong. He's at the peak of his powers. Now he's 40 years old, and he meets this one young widow who actually was one of his lay ministers, a woman. She was about 30 years old, and a very gifted teacher, gifted speaker, a real woman's minister. She and Wesley really were kindred spirits, and he wanted to marry her. And his brother Charles and even George Whitfield interfered with this relationship because this lady, even though she was a very devout Christian, was a widow, was a good woman, and they were in love, she was from a poor family and so was not quite into the strata of society that Whitfield and Charles Wesley felt that John should be marrying into as the leader of Methodism. And so they interfere, and they actually arranged for, this lady, her name was Grace Murray, they arranged for her to marry another Methodist minister right under John Wesley's nose. And so, zingo, another failure. Well, a few years down the road, what happens, Wesley gets really sick, has a protracted illness, and is nursed to health by a lady by the name of Mary, who later, I can't remember her previous name. She was a widow as well. And Wesley recovers from the illness, and he likes her. And he decides, you know, before my brother gets involved in this, before George Whitfield gets in this,
no.
I'm going to marry her. And in 1 week's time, he proposes marriage and gets married against the wishes of his brother Charles. And this lady is a lady of means. Mary Wesley, his wife, was a woman of means. She came from a very wealthy family, so she fit that criteria. But she was an incredible complainer, and she was a very spoiled woman, apparently. And Wesley, of course, you know, was a itinerant preacher.
Yeah.
That was the man traveled 250,000 miles in his lifetime on horseback and preached 45,000 sermons. And the hallmark of his ministry was traveling and doing circuit preaching. And he took her on one trip with him, and she did nothing but complain and complain and complain.
And it
just literally, you know, he said it was like tearing the flesh off my bones, her complaining. And this whole rift in their relationship, and they were only together 7 years, and they were separated the last 20 years of John Wesley's life. His marriage was an abysmal failure, and actually his wife sought to discredit him in the community, worked very actively towards that. So Wesley had a pathetic,
golly,
pathetic love life, the poor guy.
All right, and I'm just kind of taking some notes here. So that was it. Basically, they didn't see each other, and then after about 7 years,
he didn't even try to reconcile with her. Interestingly, the pictures of his deathbed scene, you know, which, of course, they didn't take photographs in those days, but they would draw pictures, you know, of famous people. And his deathbed scene, there's not a woman to be found. He's completely surrounded by Methodist ministers when he dies late in life. There was no reconciliation between them. It was a pretty sad tale, really. of you know, man of a brilliant minister, used mightily of God. Just couldn't seem to get it together in the old love department, though.
Well, you know, that's happened to some folks. But here we have Methodism. John Wesley in England. Is Methodism mostly associated with England? Seems like Methodism is mostly associated now in the United States.
Well, Methodism, of course, starts in England and becomes a very big movement. As a matter of fact, a preeminent movement in the early story of the United States. And really, up until the turn of the century, Methodism was one of the largest branches of the church in the U.S., but it was under the leadership of American Methodists that it grew. People whom Wesley had ordained and appointed over here, it was their genius. Francis Asbury, Thomas Coke, people that are related and associated with Methodism in the United States, they're really the ones who are the genius and are the ones that are instrumental in its growth and its spread here. But Wesley is not really associated, even though he's the father of Methodism. His real success was not here, but it was over in England.
And Brother Charles, did he ever come here as well? Or
He did come here, but once again, he was also an itinerant preacher, an organizer, and, of course, is known for his hymn writing. And he wrote, you know, thousands and thousands of hymns. And he's... you know, Wesley is the theological genius, the preacher. His younger brother, of course, is more the hymn writer and the worship. They were both a wonderful combination.
All right.
Between the two.
Just have about a minute and a half, but Whitfield then, just to kind of get back to this early, you know, late 18th century kind of time here, Whitfield was in this country. He did play well here.
Whitfield was a major player during what we call the Great Awakening in the United States. And George Whitfield and John Wesley had a well-publicized rift between them. They were fast friends. They worked together in Methodism in the early days. But Whitfield was into Reformed theology, whereas Wesley is associated more with Arminian theology. And so they had a vast breach between them about the nature of election and what that means. And the interesting thing was that despite the fact that they adamantly disagreed with one another theologically, they loved one another. And as Whitfield said, you know, Wesley has a mistake in judgment, but that doesn't mean that he's not my brother. And mistakes in judgment do not limit our affections. So Wesley is, you know, associated with a lot of things today. The Salvation Army, the Nazarene Church, Wesleyans, United Methodists. His presence is still felt very much to this day through his sermons and theology.
Well, Chris, a job well done, and you had to do it on your own today without our friend Matt, but it was great to have that information. Chris is the associate pastor at Trail Christian Fellowship, and we're going to do it again in another month, okay? And we'll take a look at church history for you. Hope you enjoy these programs as much as I do. I'm Pat Daly. You're listening to KDOV.
If you really want to find clear direction...